This podcast was recorded at the 2016 JAD Pro Live at App Show Conference in Washington, D.C. The title of this session is Nuances in the Management of Aggressive Lymphomas, and it is presented by Paul A. Hamlin and Michelle Wisniewski, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. To view the presentation material or see other topics of interest, please visit advancedpractitioner.com/sessions2016. To claim continuing educational credit for these activities, visit education.annenberg.net/JPL16-sessions. And now, we're delighted to bring you this podcast from JAD Pro Live.
Our first topic this morning is a lecture on the nuances in the management of aggressive lymphomas. Please join me in welcoming Ms. Michelle Wisniewski and Dr. Paul Hamlin of the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center.
I have the pleasure of working with Michelle as part of our APP team, and some of our members are here. And the goal today is going to be to give you actually a sense of some of the intricacies of large cell lymphoma management today. We'll touch on some of the themes that are in development in terms of advances, some of the side effect profiles, the prognostic and predictive markers, and where we're headed in terms of a better understanding of molecular disease biology. So non-Hodgkin lymphomas end up being one of the most common hematologic cancers, large cell lymphoma being the most common among the lymphomas. The prevalence is high since many people are cured and live with indolent lymphomas for years and decades. There's about 80,000 cases a year and 20,000 deaths, and we're working hard to diminish the death from lymphoma and making great strides over the last decade. From 2007 to 2011, the incident rates increased. They increased slightly more in men, and the lifetime probability of developing lymphoma is about 1 in 42 or 1 in 52 for a male or a female. And what accounts for some of the increase in the incidence of lymphoma really is demographic shifts as baby boomers are coming of age, and we're seeing the interplay between the aging process and lymphomagenesis, and we'll talk about that a bit. One of the ways that we keep ourselves in business is we change our classification system every few years so that nobody else can do lymphoma. So you don't have to know this exhaustive list, but it's important to know that from 2008 to 2016, there's been an update in the WHO classification. And what's called the Blue Book will be published soon. So the Blue Book has made some updates. For this talk, the germane important parts are that our pathologists are now asked to distinguish between germinal center and activated B-cell biology. Michelle's going to talk about that as we go through a case, and we'll talk about the implications for therapy. So that's there. And the other, I think, really important distinction is that we're now starting to cull out whether somebody has double hit or double expressor biology, and we'll explain what that means, but it has implications for outcome. Those in red are the areas that are either provisional or new diagnoses that covers both the indolent lymphomas, the B-cell lymphomas, the T-cell lymphomas, and Hodgkin lymphomas. So just know that this is coming out and that it is a reflection of a better understanding of the genetic basis of lymphoma. And as we have that better understanding, we can really tease apart the heterogeneity and start to identify unique diseases. We mentioned that large cell lymphoma is the most common. You see it's about a third of all NHLs. When we talk about aggressive lymphomas, we think about things like T-cell lymphoma, mantle cell lymphoma, and primary mediastinal lymphoma, as well as Hodgkin's. So with that, I'm going to hand over the mic to Michelle, who's going to talk about a patient we cared for together in clinic. And the two of us would see patients often as a shared visit initially to go through the history and the biology, and then alternate our visits with the patient over the course of their entire treatment. So it's really a nice collaborative model.
He's a 79-year-old male. He presented to an outside ER with complaints of right upper quadrant pain, burping, reflux. And he has a past medical history of hypertension, chronic kidney disease, so his baseline creatinine was elevated. He underwent ultrasound, which showed a quite large mass in the right lobe of the liver, and abdominal MRI confirmed this. Labs were essentially okay, with the exception of his ALKFOS, and he had an incidental clonal gammopathy noted. Outside pathology showed a B-cell population that expressed CD20, CD10, BCL2, and MUM1, and did not express all the rest of that stuff, and his Ki-67 was about 50%. So this is an outside pathology. When we get an outside path, sometimes even before we see the patient, we'll submit it to our pathologist for review so we have confirmation. And going through this, I want to know what the C-mic status is, and I want FISH on this patient to see if there's a double expression or a double hit. I'm sorry, double hit on FISH. So we submit that to our pathologist for those questions, and that will come back later in the talk. So this patient has a germinal-derived center DLBCL, and I know this because he is CD10 positive. And this is based on the Hans criteria that is also in the NCCN guidelines. And to figure out whether the patient is a germinal center or an activated B cell, obviously if they're CD10 positive, they are germinal center. CD10 as well as BCL6 are germinal center markers. If the patient's CD10 positive, it's automatically germinal center. If the patient's CD10 negative, you have to evaluate the BCL6 status. If BCL6 is positive, you have to establish the MUM1 status. If BCL6 is negative, they're non-germinal center, so they're activated B cell. And the easy way to remember this, which I'm not doing right now, is that CD10 and BCL6 are both germinal center markers, and MUM1 is an activated B cell marker.
So I think, as Michelle mentioned too, we keep this on the wall, and this is an immunohistochemical way of identifying germinal center versus non-germinal center. And we'll talk about how we're trying to do that with more sophisticated techniques going forward, because IHC is actually imperfect. So we'll take a little bit. So Michelle has presented a germinal center large cell lymphoma case, and we're going to try to understand lymphoma biology. And what you see here is the normal development of a B cell as it goes from a naive B cell to a mature plasma cell. And across the development of the B cell, it transits through the germinal center. And when the defect that leads to a lymphoma arises from the germinal center, there's a pattern that's shown on the left of gene activation that reflects the germinal center pattern. That terminology, if it's confusing to you, comes from the fact that there are normal B cells that have the same germinal expression, gene line expression as the lymphoma. And so they recapitulate the normal biology. If the defect that leads to lymphoma comes from a later stage of differentiation, it has an activated B cell biology. And you see actually that all of the different lymphomas arise from different B cell lineage progenitor cells. We recognize that large cell lymphomas are really heterogeneous, that we can cure a large number of these patients, but within that, patients will either do very well or do poorly, and how can we tease that apart? So clinically, we know that there's going to be different outcomes. We have gene expression profiling. Again, that's hearkening back to the normal cell component, so we're comparing the tumor cells in the dendrogram on the left to the normal resting blood B cells or the activated B cells or germinal center. Fascinatingly, primary mediastinal lymphoma and Hodgkin lymphoma are more closely related. We've identified that germinal center large cell lymphomas in orange have a better survival than activated B cell lymphomas, and that's true both in the CHOP era and now the R-CHOP era. So how can we correct that differential with new agents? And we'll talk about that. And we've moved to a place where we're starting to take those patterns of cellular activity and integrate new drugs because we have the ability to target some of those nodes in terms of things like apoptosis and NF-kappa-B, and you'll hear about that. Going forward, mutational analysis is integrated into the thought process more and more. And so at our own center, we actually are doing gene sequencing on every single patient and identifying those abnormalities that are actionable or predictive. So with all of that together, we're starting to be able to say that large cell lymphoma really isn't just one disease. It's made up of multiple different genetic entities. And in the near future, I think we're going to have treatments that are really differential based on those patterns. So how can we integrate that information in a way that helps us to take better care of our patients? Well, you heard about cell of origin. I think as of 2016, 2017, it's imperative that your pathologists are giving you that information. So your path report shouldn't just say large cell lymphoma. It should actually tell you whether it's germinal center or activated B cell or primary mediastinal, which is a different entity. Again, showing you that in an R-CHOP error, the germinal center and activated B cell have differential outcomes in terms of prognosis. We can integrate the Hans model, and as I mentioned, this is imperfect, so this is based on immunohistochemistry, and although it recapitulates the gene expression profile to some degree, looking forward, we'll likely use nanostring technology to distinguish between germinal center or non-germinal center in a rapid way, or actually just gene expression profiling overall, because that's becoming much more facile in terms of getting that data back quickly. Some lymphomas are at increased risk for central nervous system involvement, and we actually have a new model, which I'll go over in a few minutes, that can predict the risk of CNS disease, and then the next step is really how do we prevent that? It's usually methotrexate prophylaxis, either IT or high-dose methotrexate. And we alluded to this concept of double hit. And what double hit biology refers to is the fact that there are two proteins, MYC and BCL2, that when overexpressed, conspire together to create a more aggressive biology. So MYC is a cellular proliferative signal. Those cells really want to grow. And BCL2 is an anti-apoptotic signal. So those cells have a survival advantage. And there's a couple of ways that those can be deranged. You can have overexpression, hence the term double hit or double protein expressors. And that's in red. So in blue, you see the classical large cell lymphoma outcomes. If you are a double expressor, meaning that the proteins BCL2 and MYC are overexpressed, you do intermediately less well. But if you have a genetic translocation where MYC and usually the partner is the immune globulin heavy chain are deranged and BCL2, that's the 14-18 translocation and the 8-14 translocation, about 10% of large cell lymphomas will have both of those. They tend to be germinal center in derivation, and they have a very difficult outcome. On the right-hand side are the outcomes for patients treated with different regimens, and we're still in a period of prospectively trying to prove that one regimen is superior to another. I think what we can say is that although R-CHOP remains the standard, its outcome for double-hit lymphomas is woefully inadequate. And what we have looked at is upfront transplant and programs like dose-adjusted EPOC, and most oncologists will prefer those regimens because of retrospective data and now some early prospective data that suggests outcomes are better for that group of patients. And finally, moving forward, we really hope that we can integrate the genetic information into our treatment paradigm. So this is work from our own center. Andy Intelkoffer is one of our new faculty members. And what we did with a platform that was uniform, we looked at large cell lymphomas, both transformed and de novo, and asked what are the recurring mutations across the entire spectrum. And what you see in red are potentially predictive markers, so actionable targets. Things like BTK can be inhibited with drugs like ibrutinib, and if you have a mutation on an activated B-cell program, we can impact on that. And others are prognostic or predictive.
We got our pathology back from our pathologists who gave us the additional information we requested. This patient, the pathology expresses less than 20% of CMYC, and they did not have the 814 or the 1418 translocation by FISH. So 814, 1418, that's the BCL2 and the CMYC. So he is not a double expressor, nor is he double hit. We did the foundation one, and that's all the stuff after it that basically says he has lymphoma. So he presented to us in clinic with new onset, pruritus, jaundice, dark colored schools, dark urine. This is all since he had presented to the outside ER. Happened pretty quickly over a very short span. And on labs, his bilirubin was 18.4. We did a bone marrow on this patient. We wanted to know if there was some sort of discordant biology or if he was, because he was germinal center, we wanted to know if this was maybe an indolent lymphoma that had transformed into a DLBCL, but his bone marrow was negative. This is his PET, and you can see the giant liver mass, which had a really high SUV, as is typical of DLBCL. He also had kidney lesions and the diffuse segmental FDG uptake in the colon. We were pretty suspicious that this was disease, but since it wouldn't have changed treatment, we didn't confirm that. Now, the kidney lesions are interesting because, as Dr. Hamlin mentioned earlier, there is a set criteria, kind of a guideline now for high-risk CNS disease, and kidney lesions are definitely on that.
So the NCCN guidelines are really a helpful tool to look at in terms of the essential workup. Some of the things that are worth pointing out for the large cell lymphomas, and really for almost any B-cell lymphoma, is the importance of serologic testing to exclude hepatitis B, since that can reactivate in the setting of monoclonal antibodies. The consideration for lumbar puncture when you are at high risk for CNS involvement, the fact that PET scans are now integrated, and again, there's a new classification system for our staging and response. So what's important from the Lugano classification, which updated the Ann Arbor classification, are a few points, and I'll pull them out. First and foremost, we really need an excisional biopsy. And this is even more important in the current era where we are trying to get all this genetic information. Those little core biopsies just don't give you enough material to do the gene expression profiling, the FISH analysis, the cytogenetics in many instances. So as an initial diagnostic material, really request that you get that excisional biopsy. If they come with an FNA, that's not acceptable. For lymphomas that are FDG avid, which is the majority of them, PET scanning is now integrated into the initial staging as well as at the end of therapy. And that's covered and appropriate for our patients. We've done away with the A and B suffixes, so B symptoms are still noted in Hodgkin lymphoma because when they disappear, it signifies that the disease is responding, but it's not part of the staging system anymore. And when you do a PET scan, if there's no evidence of bone involvement, in Hodgkin lymphoma and large cell lymphoma, we really are less frequently doing bone marrow biopsies because one of our colleagues that Michelle's working with now, Andy Zelenets, looked at over 2,000 PET scans and was able to really show that that correlated very well with the presence or absence of bone marrow involvement. It is important, as in this case, though, if you think there's an indolent lymphoma that led to the large cell lymphoma, you will miss that with a PET scan making that decision. So in those instances, we still do bone marrow biopsy. And we interpret PET scans in the interim and at the end of therapy based on a program called the Deauville score. It came from Deauville, France. And this is based on using the internal reference of the liver and the mediastinum. So if the uptake is less than the liver, it's a score of 3 or less, and those are usually associated with excellent outcomes. And if it's over the liver or new lesions, that's usually predictive of worse outcome, although the positive predictive value is not as good as the negative predictive value. For our patients, we have a number of ways of thinking about them in terms of their likely outcome. One of the essential parts when you're thinking about a patient that you're just meeting for the first time is their clinical risk score. So the International Prognostic Index, with all of our advances, still remains important in terms of thinking about. It's based on age, performance status, LGH, extranodal sites, and the stage of the disease. And in the current era, this still predicts for a significant outcome. It's been revised in the RCHOP era. The same factors predict for outcomes that can vary, and this is survival at 4 years, from an 82% survival to as low as 60%. What you're seeing, though, in the modern era is that there's no group who's under 50% in the RCHOP era. So we've improved the survival for everyone, but we can still distinguish between those outcomes. And the revised IPI actually collapsed two of those groups into one so that you ended up with just three categories. I mentioned that there's a CNS risk profile. This is actually worth being aware of. It's recently published. The British Columbia group, as well as our colleagues from Germany, pooled together almost 5,000 patients. And they asked what predicts for the risk of CNS recovery, CNS disease in the future. And you can identify in blue a group of patients that have an over 10% risk of CNS involvement. And those were the five factors of the IPI, plus whether or not you had kidney or adrenal involvement. Those extranodal sites seem to track very significantly with CNS involvement. So with this model, you can really start to distinguish who might need prophylaxis and who won't. It's modulated by the presence or absence of double hit biology. So as a general rule, if someone has double hit biology, their CNS risk is high enough that they warrant IT therapy. And if you just remember that as a footnote, it's probably the best clinically in terms of addressing that. How we decrease that risk remains a question. IT methotrexate's been the mainstay for decades. High-dose methotrexate also has its merits and actually gives you probably better protection of parenchymal brain lesions, which is often what we worry about. So in our own practice, we often are incorporating two cycles of high-dose methotrexate, and that's about 3.5 grams at the end of therapy or interdigitated in between for patients at high risk. And this patient certainly would have warranted that. So when we're in clinic, how do we put this all together? When Michelle's met the patient, we're looking to understand who they are.
So we now have all the information, and I now have all the information to be able to go to Dr. Hamlin and say, this is our patient, what are we going to do? So we have the patient age and info, and the age is prognostic. He's 79. That is a poor prognostic factor. We have the WHO classification. He's diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. We did the bone marrow biopsy, so we know that there is no underlying indolent lymphoma. His Ann Arbor stage is stage 5. stage 4, and it involves the liver, kidney, and bowel. He is at high risk for CNS disease. His IPI is high risk. And he has a germinal center phenotype because he was CD10 positive. The Ki-67, there were some spots that actually went up to 80%, but it was around 67. And he did not have double hit by FISH, and he was not double expressor. So we have a 79-year-old male that we need to treat.
So one of my areas of interest is caring for older individuals. And with, as we mentioned, the baby boomers coming of age, it's very common that the patient you're seeing in clinic is going to be in their 70s and 80s with multiple comorbidities and concurrently with large cell lymphoma. And you're going to be facing the question of, do we treat this patient, number one? We have a curative potential therapeutic regimen, but it has a lot of toxicity associated with it. How can we approach those patients in a thoughtful way so that we offer them the best chance of long-term outcome, but we don't expose patients who are at risk for toxic therapy if it's not going to benefit them? And it's helpful for us to really look at, in the United States, who are those patients that we treat. So we looked at the SEER database. We took over 45,000 patients and drilled down to those who are on Medicare Part A and B and identified that if you look at the patients who are older, so this is over the age of 66 in the United States, a quarter of those patients never receive any therapy, even though they have a curable disease. And one of the important issues is that appropriate? Were they so sick and frail that that was the right choice? Or is there other biases at play? Is there ageism at play? Is there a lack of understanding of how we could potentially help these patients? Three quarters of those patients receive some therapy, often, again, not curative intent, and some are chemotherapy, which is the majority, the are chemotherapy. On the right-hand side, what you see is as age increases, in red, the percent of patients who are not treated increases. And not a big surprise that octogenarians more frequently than not, almost a quarter to a third of them are not offered any therapy despite having a large cell lymphoma. So how do we think about this? Well, one of the useful tools that I've referred, again, the NCCN has aging guidelines in cancer. There's life expectancy charts. And if we look at our patient at 79, if he didn't have the lymphoma with his comorbidity, if we said he was average health, he's got a survival that's predicted to be over 5 years. So his lymphoma is life-limiting, and we really actually have to consider how can we address that in a safe and reasonable way. There's a nice app. It's always nice to know that there's other ways of getting this information called e-prognosis, which also will allow you to plug in whether the patient's coming from home or from a nursing facility and what's their longevity. And I think within that framework, you can start to come up with an algorithm for making these decisions. So if we think about our patient, he's over 70. A geriatric assessment's integral to, I think, the slot process. We recommend it and use those in our daily clinic. We assess his comorbidity and predictors of early treatment-related mortality. His life expectancy is greater than 2 years, and we really want to think about curative intent for him. For patients where life expectancy is less than 2 years, palliative intent is important. And you see a reference here to lighter as we go. Jimmy Holland spoke, I think, on Thursday. She's from our center, and Jimmy's really focused on the aging process and how we actually are at times even more resilient in older age and really start to change our values in terms of what we are focused on. So for older individuals, it's often quality of life and not quantity and an aversion for toxicity. So we integrate that into our thought process. For those where we've decided that we do want to offer them curative intent therapy, we'll talk about prephase as a mechanism to try to improve their outcomes and decrease treatment-related mortality, and then the different regimens, whether it's standard therapy or a reduced dose to minimize toxicity. And for patients where we're looking at palliative therapy, we actually showed in that same publication I was referring to before that even just single-agent monoclonal antibody may have an impact on quality and longevity. So for most patients with large cell lymphoma, since it's such a chemosensitive or antibody-sensitive disease, some type of therapy will ameliorate their disease-related symptoms. As of 2017, RCHOP 21, so every 21 days for a total of 6 cycles, is still the standard. Most of the original studies were 8 cycles in the United States. Most of us are comfortable that 6 cycles is sufficient and that cycles 7 and 8 add toxicity more than benefit. We've asked whether or not dose-dense therapy every 2 weeks is superior to every 3-week therapy, and the answer prior to the addition of rituximab was yes. In the current era, we have 2 negative studies to say that RCHOP 21 is the standard. We've asked, can we do something after RCHOP to improve our outcomes? Maintenance rituximab, does that help? While it may be beneficial in indolent lymphomas for PFS, in large cell lymphoma, those studies unfortunately did not improve the long-term survival. And recently, there's data about lenalidomide maintenance that also may not meet that mark. What about upfront transplant? Is that helpful for patients at high risk? We have 5 randomized controlled trials that suggest upfront transplant doesn't offer a survival advantage. One of those studies, you can argue that the high-risk group did a little bit better. But my own personal bias is that over time, we've actually had convincing evidence that upfront transplant adds toxicity without benefit for the majority of patients. That whole discussion has been renewed with double hit biology. So I think in that setting, maybe you are identifying that 10% of patients where you can impact their outcome. So that part is still an open question. And when we think of why patients with large cell lymphoma don't do well, there's really 2 areas that we're concerned about. There's early progression of disease and toxicity. So a lot of the difficulty we experience is in those first few months, and then there's late relapses. And the strategies to mitigate those problems are different.
So at presentation, our patient obviously had a poor performance status. We decided to treat him with prephase, which for us is rituximab single agent, standard dosing times 1 with prednisone 100 milligrams for 5 days. A week later, his jaundice was almost gone and he was already improving. However, his bilirubin was still 4.9, so we could not give him RCHOP at that time. He got a single dose of Cytoxan and we got him down to the point where we could actually give him a 50% dose of RCHOP. And subsequently, his bilirubin normalized and we were allowed to finish with the rest of the 6 cycles.
So this concept of prephase was really promulgated by Michael Foinshu as an offshoot from the RECOVER-60 study, which was looking at dose-dense RCHOP. And what they noticed in their early cycles was that patients had an increased mortality with cycle 1 and 2. That's where most of the toxicity occurred. So the question was, if you're starting with physiologic reserves that are decreased and toxicity is already present from disease, can we change that dynamic? So they gave a prephase, in this case they used steroids plus a single dose of vincristine, which they could give in an outpatient setting, and the goal was to improve those physiologic reserves for patients so that they were less likely to have toxicity. And they were able to show a 50% reduction in those cycle 1 and 2 treatment-related mortality. And colleagues in France have also integrated this into prospective studies and suggested that it is a very useful clinical maneuver. So I pointed out really for this group because you're the ones who are trying to make those early decisions as you're going through staging and figuring out how to manage these patients. A week of steroids, and we took the stance that vincristine is associated with neuropathy and ileus. We'd rather give a single dose of rituximab. One of our fellows that Michelle and I worked with that's now a faculty member is part of a geriatric assessment study where we're doing geriatric assessments on every single patient serially across their therapy and looking at inflammatory markers to see if cytokine-mediated factors are at play. And a small group of patients, about 30, were part of a pilot that looked at prephase, again trying to see if we could impact on treatment-related mortality. So we talked about that regimen of a week of steroids and a single dose of rituximab, which this patient got because of the hyperbilirubinemia. When we presented this data, the patients were generally in their 70s. 75 was the median, upwards of 85 for the total age. They had high-risk large cell lymphoma overall, a very representative group, Germinal Center and ABC, about 60-40. And this was the outcome. So what we were able to show was that with a prephase, we really diminished treatment-related mortality. There was a single event out of the 33 patients. There was no tumor lysis. I think frustratingly, we didn't see modulation of that cytokine milieu with a single week of prephase. So how it's working biologically, we're still at odds with trying to figure that out. But as a clinical maneuver, this actually is a very important thing, I think, to integrate for our older patients. And it allows over 80% of our patients to get through their treatment program. One of the other clinical factors not to dismiss is dose modifications in the era of immunotherapy. So it used to be that you wanted to maintain a relative dose intensity of at least 80%. In the era of chemoimmunotherapy with rituximab, we actually have been able to maintain pretty high curative outcomes even when we reduce the intensity of the regimen. So what you see here is a listing, and I think these slides will be available, of those reduced intensity programs which may diminish the treatment-related mortality and toxicity. So there's 70 and 50% dose reductions with the CHOP regimen. The R-mini-CHOP program was specifically in patients over the age of 80 from our colleagues in France. And what you see is an overall survival at 2 years that's still 60%. So you can back off on the chemotherapy and make regimens more tolerable. And I think we can recapture that curative intent for a group of patients. Our colleagues in the United Kingdom have published on an RGCVP program, so using gemcitabine instead of doxorubicin for patients who had cardiac contraindications to doxorubicin. And those patients, again, had about a 60% two-year overall survival. So we really have a number of options that start to give us the ability to still treat those really sick patients. I will say that the data with R-bendamustine is less enticing, and I don't believe that that's a curative regimen. It's certainly being used in the community. But I think we have better data with the other regimens that we talked about. And this is just a look at that cardiac comorbidity study from the United Kingdom, looking at the RGCVP regimen in a group of patients where the ejection fraction was compromised at the beginning. So we had all of that exciting discussion at the beginning about the heterogeneity of large cell lymphoma and cell of origin and now understanding genetics, but have we moved beyond R-CHOP? So what you just heard is that it's still the standard of care. Where are we going forward? And we'll talk in a second about some of those efforts in prospective studies to address this. Most of those efforts have focused on the activated B-cell biology because that group did less well, and we have agents that we believe are distinctly active in that cellular biology. I'm not going to talk much about it, but it may be that we don't have to integrate new agents, that alternative chemotherapy backbones overcome that biology. So the RACVVP regimen, which is used in France but not in the United Kingdom, seemed to actually overcome the negative outcome for ABC. The dose-adjusted R-EPOC data seems to perform exceedingly well in germinal center. There is a randomized study that's going to be reported very soon out of the NCI and the Alliance group that's asking that question. And our own center had used R-CHOP ICE that appeared for the activated B-cell group, again, to do better, but that's not been randomized. When we think about targeted therapy, we know that certain agents may distinctly work better in different biology. And so what you see in the activated B-cell column is that drugs like bortezomib, idelalisib, ibrutinib, fostamatinib, which is a SYK inhibitor, lenalidomide, may have differential activity in ABC. And many of our prospective studies are asking whether or not you can add these to an R-CHOP backbone and impact on outcome. In the germinal center biology, we actually have EZH2 inhibitors in early development, and BCL2 inhibitors, which I believe Jeff Jones spoke about earlier with venetoclax in CLL, and that's being looked at. And that may be agnostic to cell of origin, so it may work just as well in both biologies. We've been integral in a study that's doing just that, so it asked the question if we use R-CHOP or G-CHOP, so obinutuzumab, as the chemotherapy backbone for large cell lymphoma, can we integrate venetoclax into the early outcome? So this really was for germinal center or ABC patients. And what we've been able to show in a safety lead-in is that we can safely include venetoclax. The study's ongoing as part of the backbone. The regimen going forward ultimately will probably be an R-CHOP venetoclax program, and then that will be leading hopefully to a randomized phase 3 study. So this is actually nearing or accrual's actually completed for the phase 2 in the next weeks. For the activated B-cell biology, randomized trials have been looking at those agents we talked about, and we actually have some early hints that we have to exercise some caution. So some of the early trials, there are at least three and two have read out, asked whether or not bortezomib, which impacts on NF-kappa-B, could be incorporated with R-CHOP chemotherapy. We found out that that was safe. We could figure out how to do that with some overlapping toxicity with neuropathy. But two studies now, either using VR-CAP or R-CHOP bortezomib, have failed to show an improvement in progression-free survival for large cell lymphoma. So our initial hype and hope that we could impact on ABC was modulated. And I think what we're seeing in the right-hand side, John Leonard from Cornell presented this data, is that there was no difference from the R-CHOP bortezomib to R-CHOP group, but the survival for the entire group was better. And that questions your statistical concepts from the beginning. What I think is at play is that in order to get the ABC and cell of origin information, we're delaying the ability to get patients on trial, and some of those bad players that have that early toxicity are not making it to the study. And as a consequence, the outcomes for everyone was better, and we're not seeing a differential. So as we design our clinical trials, as much the understanding of biology, as well as the way that we carry out those studies, may impact on our ability to tease this out. Lenalidomide for large cell lymphoma, we know that there was activity with lenalidomide and that it appeared to be greater in the non-germinal center with a CR rate of 30% compared to 4% in germinal center. That was a signal that was based on chronic active BCR signaling through the B-cell receptor being impaired. So what you see here is a cartoon looking at where lenalidomide may be working. We know that the B-cell receptor leads to a pro-survival NF-kappa-B pathway, and it also blocks a pro-death pathway. And when we give lenalidomide, it's exploiting what's called synthetic lethality, which means that it inhibits both the pro-survival signal as well as augmenting the pro-death signal and leading to improved outcomes. We have some early hints that, coming out of the Mayo group, that the addition of lenalidomide on the right-hand side negates that difference between cell of origin. So in yellow is the activated B-cell group doing less well with R-CHOP therapy. And on the right-hand side, we see those curves come together by the addition of lenalidomide. You've heard about some of the toxicities of lenalidomide, like rash and count compromise, but it is modulated in these programs by adjusting dose, and that toxicity is manageable. And this was specifically in elderly patients looking at the lenalidomide R-CHOP program, demonstrating overall response rates of 92% and CR rates that were 86%. So there's an exciting signal here, and it's led to a randomized controlled trial from out of ECOG looking at R-CHOP versus lenalidomide R-CHOP, stratified by age, IPI. And on the back end, we'll look at that cell of origin. Another way that we can actually impact on the BCR signaling pathway is through the use of ibrutinib, a BTK inhibitor. So what you see in this cartoon are the nodes as the B-cell receptor is actually activated. We go through SYK, which we have the ability to target, BTK, PKC-beta, and down to the NF-kappa-B pathway. And in parallel, tonic signaling through the BCR pathway is a PI3 kinase mTOR pathway. So we are looking at different ways of impacting on this signaling pathway as well as this in parallel. The initial work looking at ibrutinib in relapsed refractory ABC identified a signal. So ibrutinib was given at 560 milligrams per meter squared, and these were patients with relapsed and refractory disease. You see in the waterfall plot that there was activity for the majority of patients, and in blue were the activated B-cell patients. So this seemed to actually have differential activity based on cell of origin. That led to a phase one study led by Yannis Yunus at our group, integrating ibrutinib with R-CHOP, and we were able to establish the safe dose to move forward with an overall response rate in the 90s when you looked across all of the different dose levels and a CR rate of 70%. And again, there appeared to be a distinction between the cell of origin ABC versus germinal center. So that's led to a randomized phase 3 study, which has completed accrual. And we will get a readout from that likely in the next 18 months, asking whether the R-CHOP ibrutinib program will overcome the negative impact of cell of origin based on the Hans model. How did our patient do?
Our patient didn't do great, unfortunately. At the end of 6 cycles of R-CHOP, he still had a pretty significant liver mass with an SUV of 13.9, but the kidney nodule had resolved. So we wanted to biopsy this to confirm that it was still just our regular old DLBCL and it hadn't changed, and to prove that there was still disease there. And unfortunately, there was. It was still the same as his original pathology. The Ki-67 in certain spots was still significantly high, with an overall of 60%. So what do we do for relapse refractory DLBCL? As you saw earlier on one of Dr. Hamlin's slides, in the rituximab era, these patients tend to not do very well.
Today, the use of stem cell transplant remains the mainstay for relapse disease when patients are appropriate for that. At the age of 79, we really are pushing the limits of bone marrow transplant, and most patients in that age category have enough comorbidity that the treatment-related mortality is too high to consider transplant. We are, again, trying to address that with ways to modulate the conditioning regimens and make a transplant approachable for older individuals. But for the majority of individuals like our patient, that wasn't an option. The data for transplant remains based on the PARMA study, which compared DHAP to a consolidative high-dose therapy program after three cycles of DHAP and showed an important survival benefit. And the CORAL study was a modern and first randomized study asking whether or not a second-line regimen was superior to an alternative second-line regimen. So the rituximab ICE program was developed at Memorial. The RDHAP program really used throughout Europe and other parts of the United States. And in collaboration with our French colleagues, the CORAL study asked, is rituximab ICE superior to RDHAP in a second-line setting? And then there was a second randomization to rituximab maintenance post-transplant. The outcome from the CORAL study was that there was no distinction between these two regimens, that there was perhaps slightly more toxicity with the RDHAP program as a consequence of the cisplatinum, but we got to the same place in terms of survival. So as of today, we can't recommend one second-line regimen over the other, and there are a number of different ways to try to get the patient back into remission. The second part of this study, though, that looked at predictive values was really informative. So we know that the age-adjusted IPI is predictive of outcome, and we recapitulated that data in this study. But what you see on the right-hand side is frustratingly that the vast majority of patients with relapsed disease, so 187 out of the total population, had relapsed within 12 months of their prior regimen and had previously received rituximab. And by intent to treat, so before you initiated second-line therapy, their expected survival is actually under 20%. And what that means in the modern era is that the impact of transplant for our patients has lessened because we're curing more people up front. So in the prior era of CHOP therapy, we cured about half of our patients. And then of those that relapsed, we were able to salvage therapy. So if you took a fictitious 100 patients, we cured 50 initially, and then we cured another 15 by intent to treat with second-line therapy, and about 65% of patients were cured overall. And these are younger patients where transplant's an option. In the modern era, though, we're curing a larger group of patients, upwards of 70% with R-CHOP. And that means that the players with relapse and refractory disease have really bad biology. And only about 50% of those patients will respond to second-line therapy. So at the end of the day, the impact from transplant has been lessened for our patients. And the challenge to us as oncologists is either to determine whether modern therapies will negate the need for transplant as we explore immunotherapy, or can we integrate better ways of getting patients into to transplant, since that is the curative approach. And those same concepts that were at play in the upfront setting are at play in the relapse setting. Just looking at trials at our own center for transplant-eligible patients, we've again integrated ibrutinib with the RICE program to try to address that B-cell pathway. So ABC biology tends to relapse more frequently. In the relapse setting, if we can target the B-cell receptor, perhaps we can improve the percent of patients who get to transplant. In the germinal center arena, we're actually focusing on using an antibody drug conjugate that targets CD19 on the surface, so that shouldn't be impacted by cell of origin, and we've integrated that into the ICE program. Those are the clinical trial .gov indicators. So this is our patient, and this was his course.
So this is all of his treatment post R-CHOP failure. We did give him our GemOx, and unfortunately he progressed after three cycles, and he progressed pretty significantly. He was then enrolled on a clinical trial using SGN-19, which Dr. Hamlin just described, and he progressed after three cycles. He initially responded really well, and then just relapsed. And he unfortunately developed ocular toxicity, which is a problem with SGN-19. And he tried to hide it from us for a little while, so until his wife flew him in and called me and told me he almost hit a deer and a wall. So we switched him to CEP, and he had a partial response to that as well, but he still had a huge disease burden. By the time we got down to enrolling him in the Portola study, which is a CYK/JAK inhibitor study that Dr. Hamlin is running, his disease was so significant that after one cycle, we had to make him hospice, unfortunately.
So unfortunately for our individual, the outcome was when Murray ultimately succumbed to his disease. We did have multiple ways, though, to try to continue to address the disease after he relapsed, even though we were in a non-transplant setting. And as you saw, some of those were clinical trial options based on his biology that we hoped to overcome. What you're seeing here are the main pathways involved in the lymphomagenesis of B-cell lymphomas. And again, there are multiple places along this cartoon where we have actionable drugs that can be called to bear and may impact on outcomes. So we see some of the things we've mentioned, like lenalidomide, bortezomib, venetoclax at the setting of BCL2. We've got SYK inhibitors. We've got PI3 kinase inhibitors. All of these are being studied in the relapse setting as part of clinical trials, and if they're active, then the charge is to try to integrate them in more novel ways. So what are some of those major themes that are at play right now? We're looking at novel combinations. So less frequently is this a gamish of different chemotherapy options, but at our own center, we're looking at romidepsin, lenalidomide, and carfilzomib, so combining the proteasome inhibitor, an immunomodulatory agent, and an HDAC inhibitor to look at epigenetic ways of addressing the disease, small molecule inhibitors that impact on those different nodes in the B-cell program are being explored, and they're being explored as single agents, and what we all anticipate the future will include is actually using a combination of oral regimens together to dampen down either on those pathways that are active in parallel, so a BCR inhibitor and a PI3 kinase inhibitor, or to prevent the resistance mechanism. So if you use two agents, perhaps you can block that escape mechanism from the single agent. And that's the work that's being done right now across the United States and globally. We've also been excited about the concept of antibody-drug conjugates, and I'm sure most of the room is familiar with a drug called brentuximab vedotin that targets CD30 and has been integrated into the care of patients with Hodgkin lymphoma. We're trying to take those same constructs into the care of non-Hodgkin lymphoma patients, either targeting CD20 or CD19, but these are cell surface proteins that then can be forced to internalize and carry with it, sort of as a Trojan horse, a toxin or a chemotherapeutic to directly affect cell kill. And there's been some exciting phase 1 and 2 data that is supporting that research. And finally, you've heard about immunotherapy throughout the last 4 days. Can we engage the T-cell arm of the immune system? The sort of the holy grail is not to need transplant because you can use your own native immune system to attack the disease at hand. Can we modulate T cells by taking them out of the body, engineering them, and giving them back to the patient to target those cells with CAR T cell efforts? Can we use checkpoint inhibitors to take the brakes off your own immune system and wake up that immune system to engage the lymphomas? And are there other ways that we can use antibodies to bring a B-cell and a T-cell together, constructs called bispecifics or BiTEs, where you're bringing into apposition the B-cell and the T-cell, and that physical contact engages the immune system? So all of those themes are alive and well. These are not FDA-approved approaches at the moment. They exist in the realm of clinical research, but they're exciting things that we're going to hear much more about in just 4 weeks at the American Society of Hematology. So we're actually finishing with time for questions. So I can't thank enough the really team of people that we work with. That at Memorial, there's now an increasingly large group of faculty members who only care for lymphoma patients. We work with a fantastic group of advanced practice providers, both NPs and PAs, that are integral to our clinical research program, our survivorship program. Sharon Kurtz spoke the other day and is here. Zula is here, who works on our transplant floor often. So this really is a collaborative effort among multiple different disciplines. I have to thank all of our nurses, all of our patients, and the whole disease management team. And with that, let us take any questions. Thank you.
Hi, just a question. If, in theory, you were able to get this highly refractory patient into a CR and there was no plan for transplant, knowing that that disease would likely just pop right back up again and he'd receive the kitchen sink, what were your kind of tools that you were going to use to keep him in remission?
So the question is, if you had at any point achieved a complete remission with one of those second-line regimens, are there any strategies that might have maintained that patient in remission? And it's an important question that we struggle with. So we have contemplated things like allogeneic transplant with non-myeloablative approaches for patients in remission, even when their age is higher, because we're starting to make those a little less toxic. I think today some of the concepts are incorporating things like CAR T cells into that setting where there's minimal residual disease, and maybe the immune response actually can eradicate that clone so that we can enjoy patients having long-term survival. We absolutely have a number of patients, I saw both of them last week, who got antibody drug conjugates now over 2 years ago and have been in remission with large cell lymphoma. So there are groups of patients who are served incredibly well by those second line regimens and have durable long-term disease control even if they're not cured. I think maintenance strategies have frustratingly not been successful in large cell lymphoma. So unlike in low-grade lymphomas where we may continue a monoclonal antibody and we'll see data with things like lenalidomide, in the large cell lymphoma setting, if someone is in a complete remission, we often are at that frustrating stage where we actually monitor them and allow them to recover from toxicity, but we don't have anything preventative to offer.
I was wondering, what regimen are you using first line for double-hit lymphomas?
Good. So we talked about this because you're seeing a patient next week with Dr. Zelnitz. So the question is, for double-hit lymphomas, what regimen are we using? And I think we draw the distinction between double expressors, where there's increase in protein expression, and double-hit, where there's a translocation between the MYC and heavy chain, as well as BCL2 and heavy chain. What are you doing for your patient?
So we originally were referred this patient under the impression that he was double hit, and he had been being treated on the outside with, he had a couple regimens and kept progressing. So they referred him to us. We actually gave him our EPOC, got him into a CR after 4 cycles, and we were having a hard time getting his path to review. So we were treating this patient based on what the outside people had been telling us. And when we finally got the pathology to review and we got the FISH, he was not double hit. He was a double expressor. So the plan to go to transplant was nixed, and he is now on surveillance.
So I think that sort of treatment paradigm reflects the trend overall. So there's about 17 of us who only care for lymphoma patients. We tend to use dose-adjusted EPOC for our double hits and our double expressors, actually. And we'll recommend transplant in patients who really have high-risk disease and the FISH double hit. But even there, it's not uniform across the service.
And then, thank you. Yeah. And then along those same lines, there's a clinical trial going on looking at diffuse large B-cell lymphoma and comparing R-CHOP and R-EPOC. Do you know when we'll hear the results of that trial? Have you heard anything about that?
So the question is whether or not the prospective study looking at dose-adjusted EPOC compared to R-CHOP has been reported out. We should be hearing about that soon. I don't know if it's at ASH, but they're doing the final analysis on the outcome data, so we're anxiously awaiting for that. What we do have, which we're participating with Kieran Dunleavy on, is a MYC-positive large cell lymphoma dose-adjusted EPOC prospective study, and a significant proportion of those patients are either double-hit or double-expressors, and the data, at least in the phase 2 setting, in a multi-center construct, suggests that the dose-adjusted EPOC program remains actually a very effective program for those high proliferative rate tumors. So it's that data, as well as our own experience with EPOC, that has supported it. When you look retrospectively at programs like HyperCVAD, it's not clear that that's any better. And again, I think it's not clear that transplant's offering us the benefit we'd like.
Hi, my name is Ann McNeil. I work right across the river with Dr. Guar and Dr. Feldman.
Sure.
So I'm very curious, your initial patient who was 79, he wasn't double hit, but he had significantly bulky disease. If he were 20 years younger, what would be would your treatment strategy be the same if he was 59 instead of 79? I'm very curious. We would never give him R-CHOP, you know that. But I just want to know what you would have done in that case if he was much younger.
So the question is, how would our thought process have changed if our patient was younger and transplant was something that would have been in the thought process? I think you could make a case, although I probably wouldn't have recommended it, for an upfront transplant in this individual because of his high risk across the board. He had high risk clinical features, high risk biologic features, high risk CNS features. And in a younger patient, RCHOP is still the standard of care, as frustrating as that is. And if he was in remission, I think you wouldn't be wrong to consider a transplant. We have used a program of RCHOP followed by ICE chemotherapy that Craig Moskowitz published at our center for high-risk patients and have a PFS that's out at 80% 5 years out. So we might have used a slightly different induction regimen for him or dose-adjusted EPOC based on the prior data with germinal center biology suggests that EPOC worked exceedingly well. Again, we're anxiously awaiting the randomized study because the proof is always in a randomized study, and we will have all the gene expression profiling information from the Alliance study to either support or refute the fact that infusional chemotherapy makes a difference. I think the other thing we probably would have, in the second line, what he didn't get, and I do think this is important for the group, I personally will not use ICE chemotherapy as a salvage regimen for someone who's not going to transplant. The toxicity of ICE chemotherapy, I really think, does not coincide with our goals of care when someone is not curative. If you're in a palliative mode, ICE chemotherapy, and certainly not more than 3 cycles, is really rough. And it's often inpatients hospitalization. So what you didn't see is that he didn't get a second-line regimen like DHAP or ICE chemotherapy. In a younger patient, that would have been the second line of regimen. We actually would have opted to try to put him on a clinical trial, given his biology. And a corollary to the CORAL study was that when they looked at cell of origin, the DHAP program might perform better in germinal center, and the ICE may perform a little bit better in activated B-cell. It was underpowered to answer that question, but we tend to make that distinction just internally.
You know, and one thing we should mention is if you noticed, he was high risk for CNS disease, but we did not give him prophylaxis. It was because of his bilirubin in the beginning. We couldn't give him high dose methotrexate, and it got to the point where, when he's on a clinical trial, he was just progressing, and it kind of seemed like a moot point by then. But we did not give it to him in the beginning because of the bilirubin.
That's a good point. We actually really would have integrated that certainly in a different scenario.
This concludes this podcast from the 2016 JADPRO Live at APSHO Conference. To view the presentation material or see other topics of interest, please visit advancedpractitioner.com/sessions2016. To claim continuing educational credit for these activities, visit education.annenberg.net/JPL16-sessions.